Boyd. Up next on the Best of Think 2020, critically acclaimed writer Lawrence Wright talks about getting the facts right even when writing fiction.
My imagination kindles when I know what really happens. And it makes it easier for me to describe events and to understand the science. And I just feel more assured. And I think it creates a level of confidence with the reader when he feels that the things I represent as facts are actually true.
This hour, we'll talk to him about his eerily timely novel about a pandemic spreading rapidly and the extensive research he conducted to provide more insight into the world's handling of dangerous viruses. That's after a short break. Lawrence Wright sat down a while back to write another novel. Let me give you some of the plot points. A previously unknown virus emerges in Asia, spreads throughout the entire world, strains international relations and forces a moratorium on travel, the shutdown of schools and businesses, and frightening shortages of essential commodities. The president of the United States puts the vice president in charge of the American response, but that response is hampered by interagency conflict and lack of transparency. Oh, and the world's most powerful countries are suspected of somehow creating this devastating infection, but losing control of it. Do you have goosebumps yet? From KERA in Dallas, this is the Best of Think 2020, a look back at some of our favorite shows of the year. I'm Chris Boyd. The thing is, Lawrence Wright is no psychic. He was just paying attention to what epidemiologists and public health advocates have been begging us and our elected leaders to pay attention to for years. When he's not writing novels, Lawrence Wright works as a journalist, playwright, screenwriter, and staff writer for The New Yorker. It's always a pleasure to have Larry on to talk about his latest work, but talking about his novel, The End of October, was especially riveting and unfortunately timely when we spoke in April. As we approach the one-year anniversary of the coronavirus's discovery in China, it seems like an appropriate time for this discussion of how a novelist created a ripped-from-the-headline story before those headlines were even printed. Larry, welcome back to Think.
It's good to talk to you again, Chris.
At what point in the early reporting on COVID-19 did you start to think, oh my God, this is the nightmare I imagined?
You know, my question to the experts I was talking to, the premise of the book was, what would happen if something like 1918 Spanish flu came back? And would we be any better prepared than our ancestors were? And it turns out they had been thinking about that for their entire career. And they were all certain that something like this would happen. They just didn't know when.
What role did you imagine this book might play in readers' lives before it turned out to be so on the nose, given where we are right now? You didn't know that you would release this into a world that is dealing with a pandemic.
No, not at all. It was sort of a warning cry because the book really reflects the anxiety of so many that I talked to, that we weren't prepared, you know, that the budget cuts had really hurt, that, you know, our institutions were failing to meet the challenge, and our national stockpile was dwindling. I mean, I heard many, many different warnings from people who knew, and I did want to shine a light on their anxiety and the lack of preparedness for our own country.
I have the sense that you kept your journalist hat on while you collected information for this work of fiction. How did you go about educating yourself so you could write a knowledgeable fiction story about a pandemic?
Well, that hat never comes off, Chris. I enjoy research. I feel more comfortable dealing with reality than mere imagination. My imagination kindles when I know what really happens. And it makes it easier for me to describe events and to understand the science. And I just feel more assured. And I think it creates a level of confidence with the reader when he feels that the things I represent as facts are actually true.
So it really does function a bit like a primer on virology and epidemiology for anybody who doesn't want to read a medical textbook. Is that, I mean, your other novels have also had aspects of reality. Certainly your screenplays have. Did this research project feel different for this book, though, than others before?
Well, only in the details of it, I had a wonderful time. I know this is kind of a bleak novel, but it's thrilling to go into the world of, public health and virology and epidemiology. And, besides that, there's a lot of stuff about animals in the novel. And so I talked to veterinary epidemiologists, and I went to a submarine base in Georgia and got to tour a nuclear submarine. I mean, there were some wonderful moments in the research. I get a lot of pleasure out of finding out things. And so, if you give me a new subject that I haven't explored before, it puts a grin on my face.
Your protagonist here is Henry Parsons. How did you decide what job you would give him to anchor this story around?
Well, I needed him to be an epidemiologist so he could go wander off alone, as so many of these people do, trying to investigate a new disease. And the courage that is required is just, to me, breathtaking. I'd rather go to a war zone than, visit like an Ebola hotspot. But people like Henry Parsons routinely go out in the world to find out, what kind of disease is this? How dangerous is it? And what can we do about it? And that's his task, really. He's a part of the world. He represents so many people. But, I just thought it's kind of hard in modern day to create heroes. But it wasn't hard for me at all when I turned my attention to Henry and the world that he inhabits.
You also give him a disability caused by rickets in childhood, which I thought was such a fascinating choice for this character because it's a little bit like a massive outbreak of a fatal disease, which is to say, still entirely possible, but often assumed to be no longer a threat.
Right. It's a disease often caused by poverty or, lack of nutrition, lack of sunlight. It afflicts, for instance, women in Saudi Arabia because they don't get enough sunlight. I was inspired by that, to add that, because I had a friend in Dallas, Lonnie Cleaver, who taught at SMU, and he had rickets. And I really admired the way he handled himself despite the disability. And so in some respects, I drew from him and his character and added that to Henry.
You don't go too directly into Henry's psychology in the book, but how did you imagine his disability might have shaped his character and the sort of drive he had to succeed?
Well, he's a small man. The disease has made him small. And I think he may be overcompensating in some ways because, he's so driven. He was a man who thought he would never find love, and yet he did. And he's a devoted family man because he thought it would never happen to him. So when he gets separated from his family, his goal is to get reunited. And that's solving the disease and reuniting with his family, those are his real goals in the novel.
Henry doesn't know what their status is for a while because they're disconnected for reasons that we won't reveal here. But for me, the really most disturbing parts of the story are thinking about the people he cares about back home in much worse shape than he imagines.
Yeah, it's aching longing that he has to reunite with his family, but this unbelievable burden on his shoulders to try to stop this plague before it destroys much of humanity. And even though this is fiction, it is what happens with so many people who are in that field and trying to protect people from an onslaught of a new disease.
There's also the sense that his wife is like, dude, we need you home. She's proud of him, but she needs him. I wonder, you mentioned covering conflict zones. I wonder if you've experienced that in your life, that sense of tension between the work that drives you and what you owe the world and the needs of your family.
Well, when I was working on The Looming Tower about the rise of Al-Qaeda, it took 5 years, and about half of that time I was traveling, and I was very lonely. Yeah, and it put my family under a lot of stress. And when it came time to dedicate the book, my wife asked, "Who are you going to dedicate it to?" And I said, "I'm not going to dedicate it to anybody. I mean, 3,000 people died, and I'm going to thank my agent." And she said, you don't know what you put your family through. Okay, I got the message. So it's dedicated with a lot of love to my family.
When it came for this book to exploring how federal and international agencies and leaders might respond to a crisis, how much of that information is classified and how much is publicly available?
Listen, almost everything that I write in there is stuff that I derive from talking to people, most of them who work for these government institutions, or in books, or in briefings and tabletop exercises that were done nearly every year at Johns Hopkins and other places. This is all publicly available information, which is why the absence of preparation that for when a real epidemic comes along is so dismaying.
So, have you been able to form a theory about that, about why, we don't need a crystal ball, we don't need top secret clearance to have predicted we might find ourselves in a situation exactly like the one we're in? Why have we collectively ignored the warnings?
It's a question that you can stretch over centuries, Chris, because people have, for instance, with 1918, they simply overlooked the fact that this disease was killing more Americans than the war in the World War I. In fact, the 1918 flu killed more Americans, 675,000 of them, than all the wars of the 20th century killed American soldiers. But it was rarely commented on. Woodrow Wilson, who was president, never talked about the flu, even though he suffered from it himself and it may have led to his stroke. People forget it and they don't pay attention to it when it's happening. I think it's different now, but in the past, we've had we disregard the assaults of nature. It's war and other things that humans cause that capture our attention. And it's if we don't pay attention to nature, we're going to be in deep trouble. We've been facing new diseases, new viruses at an increasing clip. Just since 2003, when we had SARS and then MERS and then avian influenza and West Nile and Zika, Ebola, they're coming at us one after another and at a faster pace. So I think we're going to have to really pay attention now.
How did you decide specifically on your disease, which for your story is not a coronavirus but an influenza, and should we should note that is significantly more lethal than COVID-19?
Right. It's more lethal, but maybe not as contagious. I did consider a coronavirus, but influenza is still the great killer, still unconquered, comes back every year in shifting shapes all the time. It's a very, very difficult puzzle to solve. And it's responsible for the greatest plague in our history. So I thought, pay tribute to influenza, which as an additional incentive, people disregard its danger. We don't take it as seriously as we should. So far, the coronavirus has killed 50, 60,000 people in America. A bad flu year can kill that many. The difference, of course, is that in a flu year, we don't take it seriously. We don't, isolate ourselves. We don't flatten the curve. We may get a vaccine, but we may not. But this disease would have been so much worse than the flu.
I'm Chris Boyd, and you're listening back to the best of Think 2020. My guest is Lawrence Wright, staff writer for The New Yorker and a playwright, screenwriter, and author of The End of October, a novel. When we return, Wright talks about how his research took him to surprising depths, a submarine housing 40-foot missiles.
They happened to be doing a drill, and I went into the targeting room where I hope the sanest people in the world happen to be. And they said, I said, "Well, where's the button?" And they pulled out a what looked like a pistol hand grip and with attached to a cord and had a little red button on top of it. And he said, "Do you want to push the button?"
That's after a short break. This is the Best of Think 2020. I'm Chris Boyd. We're listening back to my conversation with New Yorker staff writer, screenwriter, and author Lawrence Wright. He joined us in April to talk about his book, The End of October, a novel. Let's return to the conversation. All right, Larry, there's more to the story of the H1N1 outbreak in 1976. There was a pretty robust response to that.
Yes, the anxiety that the Spanish flu would return was so great that a vaccine was prepared, rushed into preparation, I think. And, the question was, how many people are going to get it and how many people will die? Gerald Ford was the president. It seemed too dangerous not to inoculate as many Americans as could be. And so the vaccine proceeded, but many people were damaged by the Guillain-Barré syndrome that followed on some of the vaccinations. And so the question is, 50 to 100 million people died in 1918, but only David Lewis died in 1976. It was a real puzzle. H1N1 did come back in 2009 as a pandemic, but it was weaker than the ordinary seasonal flu. And so that was a total puzzle.
In your story, as in the pandemic we're living through right now, there are almost instantly suspicions that something so terrible has to be a deliberate act of bioterrorism. Why do you think we're so eager to find someone to blame for these things?
Oh, I don't think that nature seems like a challenge anymore. I think, we blame everything on others. And it's very difficult to get any satisfaction from blaming nature. So, if you have an antagonism, then you'll turn to, blame the people that you hate. And that's why, we're now, you hear these irresponsible, unproven allegations that this came out of a lab in China and maybe they cooked it up. The Chinese and the Russians are saying we made it as an act of bio warfare. The Iranians have piled on. This is all, these are very serious charges because they create a lot of hatred. And hatred creates its own constituency. And so I worry about where this is all going.
Fear is not a great motivator for making good decisions.
Oh, no. I mean, rushing, that's one of my concerns about the vaccine. We should be in a hurry, but not so much of a hurry that that we take, ill-considered advice from people in the administration to solve our problems. Vaccines are delicate and you want to get it right. And so are other therapies. They're medicines that would be effective against a disease are potent. And, we should be careful with this.
This book is also a reminder of how nobody can plan for a response or should plan for a response to a pandemic without taking the realities of human behavior into account. So early in your story, leaders realize there's been broad exposure to this disease among pilgrims at Mecca, which is like, what a nightmare scenario, right? You have 3 million people from every corner of the world with incredibly close contact for a few days, and then they're all heading back home. But you can't just assume that you can crack down on them, because if you frighten people too much, you're going to cause a revolt.
Yeah. That scene came from the fact that after 9/11, I lived in Saudi Arabia for a while. I was mentoring young reporters at a newspaper in Jeddah, and in order to, write my book on Al-Qaeda. And one of my first assignments was supervising their coverage of the Hajj. And it occurred to me right away, every year at the Hajj, there is some outbreak of a disease. People come from all over the world and they carry their diseases with them. And I thought, this is a public health hazard. It's not, of course, just Mecca or just Islam. Mass gatherings, wherever they are potentially dangerous. But the concept that you would have 2 or 3 million pilgrims and then they would all get on planes and fly to every spot on the globe, an instant global pandemic with no chance, no warning. That even then, I thought this is a very dangerous situation.
Were you serious when you said that you find something like a pandemic more frightening than covering a war zone?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you're, for one thing, the process of some diseases is so appalling to me, like Ebola. I just would never want to be subjected to it. And in reading all this history about diseases that many of which we've kind of overcome, but smallpox, plague, polio, these are appalling diseases, and what they do to individuals is really frightening to watch. Whereas death in combat, though regretful, is relatively merciful.
It has to feel strange to you, and I hope that you'll forgive me bringing this up. You are now in your 70s. You're in that group that is told you are the most vulnerable. You really shouldn't, you should avoid even trips to go out and get food. You should have it delivered or have somebody come in. I mean, are you feeling that in a different way than you might have if you were writing this story 20 years ago?
I think I am. My wife has had pneumonia twice this year already. My daughter's pregnant. I have good reasons to be concerned. And so we are, hunkered down, and it's monotonous. I'm ready to break out. And I see. I go for a run, and every day we go for a walk. The only people we see are our daughter and her husband, and vice versa. So it's a very contained world, but. But it, for us, I think it is additionally dangerous.
All right, I want to go to the phones. First up, we have Jean from San Antonio.
Hi there. My question, thank you so much for taking my call. I hadn't planned on calling in, but when I heard the author of this really important book speak about animals, I had to call and ask, in your research, did you research on the wet markets that are happening in China, in Korea, and I understand even in the United States, where animals are stacked in cages, including dogs, and being sold for meat?
Thanks for calling.
These wet markets are really problematic, and it's likely, though not yet proven, that this particular disease originated with bats. And bats, are mammals, so they are related in some distant way to humans, but typically influenzas and so on pass through other animals before they get to humans. Pigs are a typical intermediary station. So in this case, they think it might be a pangolin in one of those wet markets, and a very exotic critter. And but the cages are stacked on top of each other, one animal on top of another, and there's a great opportunity for viruses to conjoin and meet and mix and turn into new viruses.
When something goes wrong all around us, sometimes our first instinct is self-preservation, right? We're sort of wired to take care of our own. In your story, the sense that we can protect ourselves at the expense of everybody else often doesn't turn out well.
No, that's the thing about viruses. They attack everyone universally, and there's no way to contain it. I mean, when the Chinese made that declaration on New Year's Eve that there was a virus loose in China, I immediately expected that we'd be seeing it here, because you just can't contain them that easily. SARS started in China, and it was, killed 10% of the people that infected, far more fatal than the COVID-19, and it was a miracle of public health that they were able to contain it in 100 days. Were we dealing with SARS, and if it had been as contagious as COVID-19, the amount of devastation that we face would be very much like my novel.
In your story, a relatively detached from the problem president hands off day-to-day responsibility for dealing with this crisis to the vice president, who is a former radio talk host and former governor. That sounds a lot like Mike Pence. Did you have him in mind when you were writing?
Well, every I'll disqualify the, by saying that it's my characters are all individual, but it is the time is set for now. When I was writing the book. There's a template underneath the progression of this disease, Chris, which is the 1918 flu. And the disease I invented follows the course of contagion pretty much along the line of what happened in 1918. And so, and I created a calendar on my computer for where was 1918 and then where would my disease be and so on. And the calendar was happened to be the year 2020. So I am inspired by public figures that we might be seeing now, but I'm not trying to emulate them entirely.
You deal briefly in the book with the idea of something called viral sovereignty. Can you explain what that means?
It's a really odd thing, but you know, one of the reasons the book is starting, you know, in the book, the virus starts in Indonesia, which has hit the ball before like China has. But in one time, there was a viral outbreak in Indonesia, and they were trying to keep it to themselves. And by that, I mean, they resented the fact that Western scientists would come in, they would analyze the disease, they would create vaccines and so on. And Indonesia might not get any recompense for owning the disease. It was like a resource, like, you know, gold or trees or something like that, that other countries they saw as exploiting. And so an international agreement had to be worked out so that there would be some kind of compensation for countries in which diseases like that originate.
You're listening to the best of Think 2020. I'm Chris Boyd. Just to take a quick pause here, we should let people know it's a scary novel at many times, but there is some kind of swashbuckling adventure. Tell me about the research that you did into life on a submarine.
That was so much fun. I went down to Kings Bay, Georgia, which is where the boomers, as they call these intercontinental missile nuclear submarines, and they're big. And, you know, each of them is equipped to carry 24 of these intercontinental missiles. Each of those missiles is 40 feet tall. Can you imagine getting such a thing on a submarine? And I wandered through, I was taken on this tour, and they happened to be doing a drill. And I went into the targeting room, where I hope the sanest people in the world happen to be. And they said, I said, well, where's the button? And they pulled out what looked like a pistol hand grip and attached to a cord, and had a little red button on top of it. And he said, do you want to push the button? I said, and the world is destroyed. I don't know. But I pushed the button, and I think we're still here.
Let's go back to the phone now. We have Gary calling us from Austin, Texas. Hi, Gary.
Hi, good afternoon, and thanks for taking my call. I just want to ask this gentleman, then I'll hang up, okay? Mm-hmm. When I was 5 years old, I had polio. And I had polio. We were at a family reunion, and my two cousins and I, and their five were five, too, and they since passed away. But I'm 71 years old now. But all three of us at a family reunion outside got stung by bumblebees. And all three of us, basically to the hour, to the day, came down with polio. And that question I have is, he's done a lot of research on this. Is it possible that insects could be carrying it, or it could be, I guess, basically insects is what I'm asking.
Thanks for calling. What do you know about that, Larry?
I can't qualify myself as a specialist on polio. I've never heard that insect bites had anything to do with polio. Usually it had to do with public sanitation. And that's a lot of times, that's the reason that pools are so highly chlorinated. You'd have to go to a higher authority than me to ask that question.
President Trump at this moment, it's interesting to toggle back and forth from your work of fiction to what's happening now, but it's sort of impossible not to do that. He's been blaming the World Health Organization for a lack of global preparedness in the current crisis. How fair, given the research that you've done, do you think those criticisms are? And how culpable is our own leadership for a million plus cases in the U.S., just under 61,000 deaths?
Listen, Chris, the World Health Organization is not a perfect organization by any means. And yet it's the only organization has the authority to oversee the universal health situation. It unfortunately, it doesn't have any teeth. It is a supplicant. For instance, after China made that declaration, the World Health Authority wanted to go in and investigate, but China wouldn't let them for 3 weeks. You know how rapidly this progresses. But the WHO had no authority. Now, just pivoting on that one point, the budget cuts for the Center for Disease Control when the Trump administration came into office were so severe. The CDC had surveillance teams in dozens of countries around the world, including China. And that was one of the first things that got cut. Our own eyes on the ground were taken away. Even if the WHO hadn't been able to get in, we would have already been there. Now, when in December 31, when China lets the world know that there is a novel disease on the way, that's a long time before there's a death in the United States. But you can easily envision that there will be one soon. And hundreds of thousands, 5 million people left Wuhan. Many of them came to America. In fact, the very first death was someone who had come from Wuhan. So, we did nothing to prepare for that.
I'm Chris Boyd, and you're listening back to the Best of Think 2020. My guest is Lawrence Wright, staff writer for The New Yorker, playwright, screenwriter, and author of the novel The End of October. When we return, Wright explains why he included a real-life government official in his fictional world.
I like the idea of mixing the fictional world and the real world to the extent that my characters are agreeable to it. But as much as possible, I wanted to nail down the sense of reality.
That's after a short break. This is the Best of Think 2020. I'm Chris Boyd. We're listening back to my conversation with New Yorker staff writer, screenwriter, and author Lawrence Wright. He joined us in April to talk about his book, The End of October, a novel. Let's return to the conversation. Larry, I think it's the only cameo in the book. Richard Clarke appears, who people will remember had diplomatic and cybersecurity and counterterrorism roles in four different presidential administrations. How did you tell him that you would be making him a minor character in this book?
He would quarrel with the idea that he's a minor character.
Forgive me.
I just decided that you couldn't invent a better character than Dick, and so I appropriated his entire persona. And there is one other person, a veterinary epidemiologist named Emily Lankow, who was very, very helpful to me. And I like the idea of mixing the fictional world and the real world to the extent that my characters are agreeable to it. But as much as possible, I wanted to nail down the sense of reality that this is happening, to us, not in some distant world, but is happening right now to us.
In your story, what follows the outbreak is at least as destructive as the disease itself.
Mm-hmm.
We're not quite there yet, or I wonder what your assessment is of the sort of fallout of human behavior in the wake of this pandemic.
Well, it's pretty bleak in the novel, I agree, but in real life, I feel like we're in an important crossroads. And, you know, it's a crisis, you know, not just the disease, the economic fallout is terrific. And so it's a historic moment. And how will we address it? You know, wars and depressions and pandemics are like an X-ray of society. And we can see all of our flaws. And I think we're all very aware that we have them. And but will we address them? That I, you know, that's the question. You know, the depression, the Great Depression, we completely reshaped our society and made it much stronger and more coherent. World War II, you know, we became the greatest manufacturing and commercial country in history of the world. But, you know, on other occasions, like after 9/11, instead of addressing the world and addressing terrorism alone, we invaded Iraq. And I think it was a catastrophic mistake. It ruined the opportunity that a tragedy had offered us. And I think we have this other inflection point at a point where I am so convinced that more diseases will come, and history doesn't pause. It will create new strategies to confound us. But are we going to strengthen our society? You know, the Black Death, you know, was an interesting turning point. It brought an end to the Middle Ages and opened the door to the Renaissance. So we have a great, I'm not saying this is the Black Death, but I'm just saying that we have a great opportunity to, now that we're very aware of the shortcomings of our society and our science and our institutions and our politics, we have this opportunity to change it. But if we don't change it, we'll look back with great regret at the lost opportunity.
It's really interesting to me that so much is happening right now that the suspension of immigration has not gotten a great deal of attention. What do you think the repercussions might be of that long term?
Well, you know, historically, we've depended on immigration to keep our workforce going, to keep the nation robust. You know, so many people who are on the front lines of healthcare right now are immigrants. So, you know, we're depriving ourselves of a huge resource. And also, it's immigration that in large part keeps America growing. So many countries are suffering the shrinkage of their population, like Russia. You know, Putin has said, you know, that's the greatest defense problem that his country faces is the diminishing population. We're not facing that in some ways because of immigration.
All right. I want to go back to the phones. Next up, we have Rick calling us from Allen, Texas. Hi, Rick.
Yeah, it's a great show. I really appreciate that. Why is that all these SARS and MERS and all these things start from China, Philippines, Indonesia, those tropical, subtropical countries, but not like India, which is highly populated, and Sri Lanka, those kinds of countries. Any reason why?
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, now MERS is short for Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, and it was originated in camels in Saudi Arabia. So that's an exception. But you're correct to say that so many diseases originate in China. And also, you know, I think part of it has to do with the wet markets that was alluded to earlier. There's avian, you know, the flyways. Birds often carry viruses, and they fly over China, which is, of course, an immense country, and they spread it into domestic fowl. And that's another route in which especially avian influenzas come. But, you know, it's totally possible that other diseases will originate elsewhere and have, but China has certainly gotten the brunt of it lately.
The thing I can't get my head around still is how quickly this has all happened. Like a year ago, I don't know what we all would have imagined if someone had said we would be, much of the world would be sheltering in place as we speak. And this is reality now. I wonder if, having done this research, you were fully able to imagine a world in which everybody was sheltering in place.
Well, in fiction, it was possible, you know. it wasn't the world that I expected that I would be living in, but it certainly was a world that I can conceive after talking to people who had been thinking about it for their entire careers. So you know, that the novel was shaped by the experts who in turn shaped my own thinking.
It sounds like, and there's an extensive list of people that you spoke with at the end of the book. It sounds like people were eager to talk with you, like they've been trying to get someone to pay attention to this stuff.
No doubt they were. You know, they were shocked by the, you know, the lack of preparation, the budget cuts and things like that were very concerning. But there's another quality I would point to, Chris. These people are puzzle solvers. A virus is a puzzle. And, you know, on a couple occasions, I would write myself into a corner because I am not a scientist and nor a doctor by any means, but I would imagine something happening. And then I would call my experts and I say, how do I get out of this trap I made for myself? And they were delighted. Oh, I was posing an interesting problem to them. And I think that kind of mentality is exactly what you need when you're dealing with something like this. And for in the case of dealing with me, with my questions, it was fun for them. Right now, those same people are, you know, soberly addressing, you know, trying to create a vaccine or some sort of therapy to solve a real problem. But when faced with an imaginary one, I can't tell you how much fun it was to deal with them.
Different parts of the world, different parts of the country have experienced this in really different ways. When do you think it will be possible for us to get a sense of which precautions and responses have been necessary and effective, which ones might be underdone, which ones might be overdone?
Well, I'm afraid that we will, you know, some people will look back and say, well, it wasn't this serious. And, you know, and disregarding the extraordinary sacrifice that individuals have made to isolate themselves and flatten the curve and, you know, and the strides that our scientists and doctors are making in trying to find some sort of therapy, not to mention a vaccine. So they'll, you know, it'll be disregarded. And that would be a horrible mistake. The lesson we should take from this is that the self-isolation, which has come at great sacrifice, has allowed time for therapies to, you know, even this week we're seeing remdesivir as a possible therapy. The plasma therapy seems like it might be very promising. So people will live because of the time that we have given scientists to work on this problem.
You're listening to the best of Think 2020. I'm Chris Boyd. I think if I recall correctly that plasma therapy, again, is a feature of the novel.
Yes, it is. I became an early advocate of it because it was intriguing to me. It's an old method, and it hasn't always been successful. But it was tried in 1918, and that, you know, and my research, I had found out about that. And so it becomes one of the approaches that some of my heroes in my novel have attempted.
Do you feel like the work that you had done caused you to prepare for this? I mean, before the reporting about COVID-19 started coming out, did you have a supply of stuff at your house to ride out a little time at home?
Yes, I did. I mean, I ordered masks and gloves. We got some, you know, canned goods and stuff like that. Not nearly enough. Fortunately, the food supply hasn't been really destroyed as it might have been. But I was not a prepper. You know, I wasn't overly prepared. And I did get toilet paper. I have to say, I give myself credit for that.
It's strange now. I mean, at least in this country, it has not been very typical for people to walk around wearing masks. That may change in the foreseeable future. But but I wonder if this pandemic was the first time you went out in public wearing a mask, or because you've lived in different parts of the world, if that was something you were familiar with before.
No, I don't like wearing a mask. I do it, but it just feels weird. It's like not having your clothes on or something, you know, just odd, you know. Our political columnist in the Austin Statesman remarked, who doesn't want to walk into a bank with a mask on? there's a sense of, you know, taboo in some ways. But on the other hand, I appreciate the fact that, you know, it protects us, it protects other people. And, you know, is something that we may have to get used to in the future.
You seem really well prepared at this moment to write the nonfiction story of this pandemic. Do you have any appetite for that?
I'm thinking about it. I don't know. I mean, I'm in some ways I feel worn out with the subject. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I've done a lot of the research already, and I am avidly following what's happening day by day. So yeah, it is on my mind.
How often are you coming upon misinformation that people seem to believe? Are you in your Facebook feed getting the, you know, circulated emails of, you know, stuff that's supposed to cure this disease that clearly doesn't, according to scientists?
Oh, it's not, it's not subterranean. I mean, this hydroxychloroquine, you know, for instance, was not something that I had much faith in, and I had friends and even relatives who took it for other diseases, and it's a potent, disease, and as we know, it causes heart arrhythmia and occasional death. So I was a little alarmed by the way it was trumpeted as a cure-all. And, there are other approaches that, I worry about some of these things that are suggested as, organic cure-alls. The truth is, this virus is really complicated. We're learning new things about it every day. It's this whole thing about being asymptomatic and yet contagious. It's true that that's true of some other diseases, but it's maybe for 2 weeks. Now we're finding people shedding virus for 2 months. Are they, when you have the virus, are you immune? Well, some people are and some people aren't. These are confounding attributes that you rarely see with any other virus.
I feel like half my friends have already begged me to give them my copy of the book. I actually have a digital copy. And half of them say they're terrified to read it right now. Have you kind of seen that response from readers?
I think it divides in half. And I understand if people are reluctant to read about a ravaging disease in the middle of another epidemic. But some of my readers have said how consoled they are by learning exactly how this goes down, what the virus is, how it's treated. And also, they're reassured by the ingenuity and the courage of the people that are fighting it, like the heroes in my book.
That was my conversation with New Yorker staff writer, playwright, and screenwriter Lawrence Wright. He joined us in April to talk about his book, The End of October, a Novel. If you like this conversation, take a listen to all of our Best of Think 2020 shows. You can find those conversations on our website, think.kera.org. You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter at KERA Think. And subscribe to our podcast free wherever you get your podcasts by searching for KERA Think. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.